Hey, welcome to the Runaways podcast. My name is Cody. Today I am joined by Dan, as always. And then we also have Noah with us as well, who was not able to make it on the last episode, really wanted to make sure I got him on here, especially for this topic, because today we're going to talk about, you know, something I've heard going around by a lot of people lately, which is that no one is actually good at Fab yet. And more direct, like in like a year or two, or even 5 years from now, people are going to look back and think about how poorly everyone played the game currently. So we're going to talk about that, see if it's accurate, see if we believe in that, and kind of dig into that a little bit. But first, Noah, I know you had a pretty crazy travel schedule recently. You went from what, Pro Tours to the UK immediately afterwards for work? Yeah. How was that?
Yeah, it was quite a long flight. Luckily, I had like some of the best airplane food ever. I left at like 10:30. I kind of, I don't know if this is standard among card game players, but I poorly budgeted my time that it would take to get to the airport. So I got to the airport at like 9:30 and my flight left at 10:30, and it's an international flight. So like, you know, you're supposed to get there at least 2 hours early. So yeah, the people at the front desk weren't too happy with me, but I managed to get there safely, landed the next day, had a conference, and was able to spend some of that time on the plane doing my like tournament report write up. So used the time productively and then kind of shifted focus to work for the rest of that week.
Cool. And Dan, you have left us to play Alpha Clash recently. So how has your Alpha Clashing been going?
I mean, I played 2 total games in the last like 2 months. But no, I'm excited. Not fully committed to Vegas yet. They have like a calling tournament coming up, but I'm hoping to make that event. And we have a little secret crew of like 10 flesh and blood players that are planning to invade and try and spike that event. So that's been fun. I've really been playing Star Wars if I have free time. I really enjoy that game.
Apparently, the word on the street was that Peter Ward, I think is his last name, the guy who top 8ed the Pro Tour, has like basically been playing zero Fab and then top 8ed the Pro Tour. So maybe this bodes for your success in Alpha Clash too. You don't actually need a lot of reps to win.
Could be. I don't know. The 2 practice games I played were pretty rough. I like forgot, like, I don't know. I forgot everything about the game, like what order you draw cards and ready things and all that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kind of our break time. I mean, we get it probably what, like another good week. And then it's like light testing because, you know, Dromai is going to be gone. So you'll have to do a little bit of testing for Pro Tour or Pro Quests that are going to be going on. First week will be standard. And then after that, you're kind of going to want to shape things up around the fact that Dromai is gone. I just want to say thanks for everyone who has joined the premium Discord, especially the people who have joined to take advantage of the fact that we put out our full sideboard guide and our full gameplay notes for the Dory deck that we brought to Pro Tour. I'm pretty proud of that package. I think that package is really, really strong and not something that you often get. It has the whole deck list. It has all the sideboard buttons for every single hero in the game. It also has a game plan, like it's like 3 pages, I think, that has every single hero in the game as well, what you're trying to do when you sit down across to play. It's like a really quick way to catch up on how to play the deck at a very high level. And I think that's been well received by everyone who has joined the Discord for it. So pretty happy with that. Okay. So without further ado, let's get into our main topic. And I have been hearing from people doing interviews or from other podcasts or just people in general, kind of this notion that they think that the current players that are playing the game are not technically very good at the game. When we look at a game, it's like back in the early days of Magic, how if you look back at those people playing, they weren't very good at what we would consider, you know, Magic at the time. And I posed the question kind of as a general thought, and we'll go deeper into other things. But just, do you think this is accurate? Do you feel like it's obviously different games. So do you feel like there is such a big gap from what we'll have or as like a standard of play in 2 years or 3 years from now, that this period of time will be looked back as people not being nearly as good as we think they are currently?
Go ahead.
Yeah, I just think the gap, like, it's always going to grow, right? Like, the longer the game exists, the more, like, people front load the work of learning the game for you and you can get up to speed. Yeah, it's an interesting question. Still thinking on my answer, I think. I feel like we've seen plenty of people.
If you want to
you can
marinate a bit. Yeah. I can ramble for a sec, put you to sleep while you're thinking. So I think one of the biggest reasons why people make mistakes is before the game starts, as you were mentioning, Cody, how you have full, not just sideboard notes of what cards you're putting into your deck, but the precise nature of your game plan and the specific matchup. This is one area that I think, unless you've put like infinite reps, and reps in a sense of you're actually analyzing not just who ended up winning or losing the match, but what were the outcomes of key decision points? Did you make the right decision with the information you had at the time, not like hindsight of, oh, this happened to work, so I'll try it again next time. So before the game starts, like having that game plan of what you intend to do with your cards, since in Fab all the cards are so modal, right? This is like one of the differences with your Magic example versus Fab, of why there's potentially like a larger learning curve in Fab, is when you see a card like, I'll just take KO for example, since that's the deck I'm most familiar with. If you take a card like Savage Feast, the card really has three ways you can play it, right? You can play it off of an agility. You can play it by using Tunic, or you can just block with the card. So it's like in each different matchup that you play, you could categorize it as having a different role in your deck. And if you don't know that going into the matchup and you end up playing the card in the role it's not designed for in the matchup, then you'll end up with like a worse outcome.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think my mind was recently changed on this. When I was hearing this probably a couple months ago, or, you know, like half a year ago, I didn't 100% agree. I think since we are the nature of a game that is built on math, which is a lot different than a lot of other card games. Almost every decision and every card that you play and everything that you do can be broken down in a math basis. So there is like a little bit harder to say that like we aren't playing correctly currently, because we can, again, put those building blocks down into like a complete math framework and say, hey, is this math even make sense? And you can't always do that with other games, because there's typically a lot more like nuance into the decision making. But recently, after this last weekend, and after actually sitting around and watching games and thinking about it a lot more, I think my mind was changed. I think the opposite. I think we're being held back because we think it's completely a math game. There's like a lot of how we play. And I give a really good example. When I was watching the other Dory Hatchet decks play, I noticed this pattern that kept happening. And I think I mentioned it at Pro Tour, which was like, they would get stuck with like three cards in their hand quite often, just by the nature of how their deck was constructed and like not having Tunic and other things like that. So like their opponent would play out the turn, then it would kick back to them and they'd have three cards in hand. If you don't know, most of the time our Dory build has two cards in hand when it goes back to our turn. We're trying to block super efficiently and get numbers on both sides. And then we go to our turn and swing as efficiently as possible. But they would often have three cards going into their turn. Even if one of the cards was like completely useless, what I was noticing that their opponents were like really blocking them a lot more and giving up a lot more cards because they were afraid of that third card. And in our testing, we weren't really afraid of the third card because we had like a deeper understanding of how the deck worked. And so we found that like holding the third card was like not like you didn't get any benefit from doing that. You had a math trade. You decided not to block for three. And instead of not blocking for three, you now have this card that you're probably going to set because you're probably not playing a three card hand. But I noticed that the other Dory lists were getting a lot of advantages and they kept snowballing that turn after turn because their opponent would give up a little bit extra that they normally wouldn't. Maybe it's like an extra piece of boots or an extra armor piece early so that now their bigger turn later can actually punch through better because they don't have that armor piece. Maybe it's just I took two on the first one and then the second hatchet is swinging in and you're holding a card. I'm just going to give you a card here that I normally wouldn't, because they're afraid that you're going to go over the top for plus three. So they want to get that. They don't want to take that much damage. Right. And then that would lead into them having less to punch back with and leading to the other Dory deck having more cards in hand more often. And when we play, we removed a lot of the thought from the opponent. We're just playing math, right? Like, we're just playing, like, it's more efficient to block for seven on your turn and then go to my turn with two cards and play a Blade Runner and swing twice. But your opponent doesn't have to make any decisions there because everything's on the table. And when most people, when we were playing and testing, even if we were holding the extra card, it still felt like everything was on the table because we knew it was in the deck. And I think we were, like, missing that small part of the game, which happens a lot in Magic and happens a lot in other games, which is like bluffing or additional value you can get when your opponent has to make a decision that they don't have full information of. And looking at stuff like that is really what has kind of probably changed my mind on it. I think because we're thinking purely in a math basis for a lot of the parts of the game, we're missing out on a lot of the actual play aspects of the game, where you're actually playing your opponent and you're not just playing your cards and you're not just playing your deck. You're playing the person sitting across from them and then trying to make them make mistakes. And we don't really do that in Fab. We just play our cards and see what the math works out to be, you know, at the end of the game. That's typically how we try and play. Obviously, people still make mistakes, you know, with their cards, but we're not inducing as many mistakes.
Yeah,
I'm curious your thoughts on this.
I think the one aspect where people actually do bluff, whether they're doing it on purpose or not, is into something like Kano, where you'll, like, intentionally hold back cards that may not actually be blue cards, but you're, like, forcing the opponent to respect the fact that you could have a blue in hand, so maybe they can't combo off and kill you. But in reality, it's like a red that you're going to arsenal. So I think that's, like, one aspect where people kind of oops into the strategy you're referring to. But it also, just coming from the opponent side, because, like, I don't know, I feel like the point of why we're doing this is to help the community grow and get better, right? Is if your opponent is keeping a three-card hand like that, you can actually get a lot of information based off of the one card that they chose to block with. Because if they chose, like, say, it's like the Hachidori Mirror, for example, they block with, like, shoes on the first hatchet, block with a card on the second one and take three. So they're keeping three cards in hand. Then based on the card that they blocked with, you can use that to not have the third remaining card in their hand be a complete mystery to you, to help you influence your blocking decision.
Agreed. I think a good example is, like, something I've seen Yuanji do a lot that I don't see anyone else do. And when he was really practicing with Azuri, there was be times in the game where he would hold an extra card. And he would just Azuri a card that he never planned on putting in play. So he'd play the stealth card. Then he would activate Azuri ability and banish a card. And then wait for his opponent to respond. And then just not resolve the card that he banished. And it kind of reminded me of, like, playing poker, where an old strategy used to be that you'd go and sit down at a poker table. And you would do nothing for, like, an hour. You would just fold. And then when you played your first hand, you would just make a huge bluff because you were playing so tight the entire hour. People are, like, immediately folding to you because they think you're a tight player, and then you show the bluff, and that just, like, completely blows up the table image. And it's, like, something very similar with the Azuri. Like, early in the game, you can just, like, take an extra couple points of damage and make that play, and they're gonna think, you know, they're gonna respond to it if they have, like, a D-react or something. But as soon as they see that you don't actually put the card on top and you just let the stealth guard go through, like, that changes the entire dynamic of the rest of the game. And Azuri games are very long. So that means every time you do that play, now you're introducing another thought into their brain, which is, well, is he actually even going to put anything in play? Like, because you've shown that you're willing to do that at the very beginning of the game. And that's, like, not something anyone does. Like, that's not a play that anyone makes currently. But it's something that, like, can be done. It's a real play that you can do. And it's, like, a different level of playing the game, of where you're playing the game against your opponent, not just playing your two decks against each other. And it's, like, a level that I don't think very many people, one, think about or have gotten to at this point.
Yeah, I think it's a great point. And I was going to shout out UNG as well. Like, I'll be testing and he'll be, like, watching me play, and he'll just, like, randomly yell at me for making a play. And I'm like, what do you mean? The math says I should do this. But he's like, no, like, you have to think about what you're representing. And yeah, I think most of the player base is, like, missing that aspect of, like, representing information and using that to kind of deceive your opponent. But going back to your earlier point, like, even just looking at the math aspect, like, there's, like, infinite decision points in a single game of Flesh and Blood. Like, if you actually factor every decision of, like, how you use every card and, like, how they affect each other. So, like, I feel like the room to, like, perfect that is like will forever be chased. Like it's so hard to play actually perfect for an entire tournament on every decision. So I think from that perspective, like, yeah, we should always be getting better at this game, right? But I don't know. I've definitely had a select few prove to me that they are in fact good at Flesh and Blood in my eyes, because they think of things at a higher level, like things that Cody mentioned there, or with their like game plan strategies. Like when you're playing a game and you notice that your opponent has played in a way that you're now like checkmated before the game's over, and it's not just math. Like that's what I kind of feel like when you realize like, oh, they know what they're doing here, right?
I mean, I think it's one of the reasons people struggle under Prism. And I had this happen a lot when I was trying to teach some people on the team how to play the Dory deck into Prism. It's just like, at some point you have to stop doing math because like, it doesn't matter against Illusionist. Like, it's just not like, it's not real. And that was one of those other sides that made me think maybe math is holding us back. Obviously math is the building block of the game and like still very important, but there's like a point of going too far. And technically, I'll give the example is like you're playing Hatchet Dory. Your opponent has like a Genesis or some other aura, any aura that you want to say is in play. And then you swing Hatchet at their face, you play a red Blade Runner, and now you have another Hatchet swing that's going to come in for six. And most people are not willing to put that Hatchet into the aura, right? Because it feels terrible math-wise. It's just like you should take your six and you should put it into the person's face. However, the Hatchet should always go into the aura. You should always be clearing, and you shouldn't like it shouldn't bother you at all. And now you could technically say that the aura is worth more than the six to their faces, and you could try and do the math on auras. I know that Fino and I spent a lot of time back in the original Prism days trying to put a math value on a yellow aura in the Prism deck, and I think we eventually got to around 8 points. It's like worth around 8 points per yellow aura, which is kind of shady math. It's like, you know, it's like pretty hard to do that. But that's like one of those examples of like when you're playing against Prism, like the raw number math just doesn't matter. The overall game plan does. And I think a lot of people haven't been explored that into other matchups.
Yeah, I think you can arrive at that numerical value somewhat simply, right? If it's a four cost aura, right? It's like assuming every fab player just averages out a card to be worth three. It's like you spent two and a third cards playing it. So it's somewhere between seven and eight value. So it makes sense to just like, if you're using the math there of Red Blade Runner contributing six value to their face versus the aura being worth seven to eight, then it is reasonable to still, you know, quote unquote, waste the Blade Runner killing the aura.
Yep. It just feels bad because you technically could have wasted any other card to do it. And that's where it gets like dubious. Mm-hmm. I think like another good topic that was brought up, there was like an article linked to Magic Player, and everyone's probably going to throw a fit at me here, but it was from Pablo Vitor. Much longer name than that. I know he's like, I think he's world champ or something like that. I've seen the name before. I just don't know 100%. But there was an article that was linked that was talking about, was talking about his rules. And this is kind of where this topic, you know, was born from. And it was PV rule one. And it says, at a high level of play, it is better to force a poor outcome than give your opponent a choice that includes that outcome. And it's a little like esoteric, but basically it's saying like it in smaller words, it's just like it's better to force an outcome that has a lower overall value than an outcome that could have a higher value, even if like you're making that decision for your opponent, even if it could include higher or lower variance. And I kind of attribute this to how I play against KO when I'm playing, you know, into their helmet. It's like really, really annoying. Because they can decide any time that they want to block for two and then rip a card out of your hand. And for a while, we were trying to play in like a style with a Dory deck that meant like no matter what they hit when they decided to resolve their helmet, that we could still have go again and play through. But like that wasn't like a guaranteed way you could play the game. Like you don't know when their big power turns are going to come where you have to like slam a bunch of cards in front of it and then you only have two cards and then they juice you and then they go back into another big turn because you need to be able to punch back a little bit after a big turn. Like we couldn't control that throughout an entire game process. And how I started playing into it was like really simple. There'd just be like a turn on like turn one, two, three, like one of these turns, I'm just going to block with two cards in my boots and go down to two cards. And I'm just going to give them five value for their helmet. Like, I'm just going to present them an opportunity where they should block with their helmet. And I want them to block with their helmet. And so like, I'm going to swing a hatchet. I'm going to be holding a go again. Pretty obviously I've blocked with my boots. So I obviously want to put my boots back up, and I'm just going to hold that one card that I'm going to play with go again and give them the option to just like put the helmet in front of the hatchet and stop the other hatchet from coming in and give them a very obvious amount of value. And I don't think
they should block there though, right?
I don't think they should.
I don't think it's quite the same, because you're deceiving them on the value. You're doing the second step in the document.
I'm presenting them with the opportunity that they're technically looking for, right? Like, this is what they want, right? They want to be able to stop the second swing, but I'm doing it on like an environment that's like what I want, essentially. But it was like, people would still take it because they're getting like a guaranteed five value for the helmet. But I'm fine with that trade because I don't give them seven or eight later in the game, right? Like, I guarantee that they don't get seven or eight later in the game. Now, later in the game, they could only get two sometimes. And that happened in my game on stream. You can see that I presented an opportunity to just stop one card from my hand and stop the hatchet swing, and he didn't take it. And then later in the game, when I gave him another opportunity, it didn't matter what he picked, and he ended up only getting two value out of the helmet. So in that case, it was better for, you know, for me that he didn't do it. But I find that when I'm playing into that style, I think our math is a little off on it, because I get to keep the card that gets intimidated, right? A lot of the times they're thinking, oh, I stopped a 6 damage swing, or I stopped a 5 damage swing, and you didn't refresh your boots. And yeah, there is a loss, but it's kind of just a delay. It's not even a loss. It's like you delay.
Yeah,
you,
that's what I'm saying. Like, really, I don't think
you really only lost my boots. That's the only thing in my mind that I lost is my boots, because I'm going to put this card in my arsenal and play it next round. I'm technically half a turn behind in damage now for whatever relevancy that might have to the game. So that has to be categorized as some sort of loss, right? But overall, I think the numbers, and when people see what the number, you know, it looks like, they look like they blocked 5 or 6. I don't think it's as straightforward as that.
I think they go +2. Because you convert a card to 2 damage, where 3 is your baseline, like every card in the deck blocks 3, and you lose the boots.
Yeah. I think this is another situation, too, that opens up. I don't necessarily agree earlier, by the way. I kind of refrained from commenting about the whole Yuanji, like, just go neg one card strategy. But I think this situation where the bag is involved actually opens up areas where you can assess how your opponent is going to play their flesh bag if you present this scenario to them early enough in the game. Mm-hmm. And you can kind of like draw attention to be really debating about what you're like blocking with. I always say, like, this general guideline in FAB is to like plan out your next turn when you're blocking on their turn. So when you're blocking on their turn, if you block with 2 go agains and then like keep 2 cards in your hand, one being a blue and then one being an unknown to your opponent, they're thinking it's like 99% chance you have a go again if you're going to swing like this, right? Whereas it could just be like a dereact. So like, this is an area where you can see, like, you're basically gambling. You're gambling like 4 value, kind of, or like the same 2 value, however you want to look at it. If you think of your set card versus having a second swing, because you probably only do this gamble if you have like a powerful card to set anyway. So you're like gambling on the flesh bag, where if your card is like a sink below, then they just bagged for basically 0 value. And if they don't commit the bag there, then you now understand more about your opponent of when they're going to use their bag later on in the game. So you like, you check for this early in a way that's advantageous to you in both regards.
Yeah, that was, I mean, that was the whole idea of when I started doing it. As well. And it's just like, but I just don't see, game plans like that very often. And it's not me trying to toot my horn on this or anything like that. It just happened naturally while we were like testing, but it was like another little dig into my brain of like, there's more we could do than I think we're currently doing than just playing the math hands at each other. Right. It kind of feels like there was like 2 major breakthroughs in the game, and I'm waiting for the next breakthrough. And like, the first breakthrough, in my opinion, was second cycle matters. That was like the first breakthrough. And that happened kind of at the same time. It happened with Chain when everyone started actually blocking a lot. And that kind of culminated into the old him going from a terrible hero that everyone thought was bad to old him being a good hero, because the entire strat was block, swing, hammer, and pitch stack Oakenolds, and then just Oakenold on the second cycle. And that was like the first introduction. And then Starvo was the second introduction of like bottom pitch stack matters. And that was like the first, I think, you know, one of the major breakthroughs in the game. And then the next one was definitely the Icelander deck, because that was the math matters deck, in my opinion, when they started putting Woundables into Icelander. I will 100% say that from that point on, while people were still doing math beforehand, and that's something that we did, you know, in Chain and other decks quite often, it was not as central focus of how the game operates in my mind until that deck really came in full swing. And then it from that point till now, it feels like we're in the same era of just math matters. And I'm waiting for that next third pillar to come into the game that I don't think we've seen, you know, completely drop yet.
Yeah, I think the thing with the Icelander deck too is that it asks your opponent a lot of questions, which I don't think most decks do right now, besides like maybe Illusionist. Like that's why our Nationals Phylos was so good. Like the whole deck was just built around asking at least two questions a turn of your opponent. Which that lets you play into like the deception and all that too, right? But if you're just presenting numbers, then it's kind of the skill expression is limited, right?
Yeah, I just think the way that card design has gone now, it's like most of the things that ask your opponent questions, you think of probably like a more aggressive Bravo that's like presenting crush effects, or like an Azalea, which are inherently kind of inconsistent strategies, or like a Ninja 2 Katsu, right? Like my Katsu opponent went Kadachi, Kadachi, Dishonor, pass, but then sometimes they just like do 30. So I think, yeah, one of the problems with why the asking your opponent questions thing is kind of phased out is we don't have a hyper consistent way of doing that like we do with Icelander.
Yeah, that's a good point though. Like the three new Mysteria heroes, they're all like the ask your opponent questions heroes, right?
Mm-hmm.
Assassin, Ninja, and Illusionist. So we might get some of that back, and we might be doing a little more bluffing and that sort of thing.
Yep. And if we're based around blues and instants, then they should be like theoretically pretty consistent, right? If like you're intending on casting blues.
Yep, that makes sense. I also think another big skill I don't think people have are missing right now is being able to judge where they're actually at in a game accurately. Because I don't see very many people's play patterns change as the game goes on. It's still just play hand that makes most math sense. And while that's still good, like there's nothing wrong with that, there has to be a point where like that's just not right. And we're starting to see that a little bit with scabs. Like that's when it's like popped in, right? Because like it's like a really easy lever to look at to be like, I'm really behind. Maybe I should just roll scabs and see if I win, like can come back, right? Like, and that's like a real thing that you should probably do some percentage of the time. And I think that's like the next lever, because it can even be as simple as like, I'm behind here. If we continue this strategy, I'll probably lose most of the time. And people don't know what that percentage is yet. Like we don't know how often it is that your opponent bricks and that you get to come back in the game. Cause that's the current strat is like the current strat is I'm behind. So I need to play as efficiently as possible and just hope that they brick a hand. And I hate that, but it is like the current way to do it. And there at some point might be a more of a play of like, I'm really far behind. I lose this game, say 85% of the time. If this continues, it might be a higher percentage for me to like hold more cards and bluff a bigger turn and get something out of them to try and take some momentum back, right? With like relevant on hits or something. And that's like not something that's done very often right now, outside of now it's starting to be thought of in Scabskin's world.
So I think a good example is like Sync Blow. Like I do this as a ton of nerd. I do this a ton in our Dory deck. Like if I'm recognizing I'm behind in the turn cycles, I'll start greeting my Sync Blows to like hit the high roll go again, that kind of thing, instead of like doing the safe option. I think a lot of decks actually have like the means to do that kind of thing.
Yeah, where you throw the boots in, you throw all your blocks in, and you're
exactly,
just like, I hope I hit a go again. And like, that's all.
Well, it's
not
I hope. It's like, no, I need to hit a go again because I'm behind. This is how I come back.
Yeah. I think people like draw. They would say that what you're talking about right now, Dan, is super different than rolling scabs. When in like reality, if you do the math of like the odds of you drawing a specific go again, is probably lower than the odds of you like hitting two action points, right? But like what you're doing is
not in Durandia, but I hear your point.
You play like 35, right? So it's like about 50%.
Yeah.
Which is like about the chance of hitting two action points.
Agree. We can talk about scabs if you want.
No. I was just saying in general, like
that's a whole other topic.
Yeah, it wasn't meant to be about scab specifically. It was just about people not understanding percentage. But I wanted to say one more thing too, is about like identifying how you do win, because you can make these gambly plays, but like, is that the play that lets you win? Or like, sometimes you just have to pause, like take 15 seconds, be like, okay, like what is the scenario where this game turns to allow me to win? And then try to play for that. I had an example too that came up for me where I ended up punting this game away because got tilted, which is a whole nother topic. But I put myself in a chance to win of like my opponent. I see that they're playing six pulpings. So I'm like, okay, the way that I can win this game now is if I draw one of my reckless swings and I'm able to set it, then like I can potentially make them IP2 or IP3 themselves. And then that's like the play that will shift the game in my favor and I can become the aggressor from there. And I end up lucking in like to actually happening. But I think, yeah, just identifying like, okay, what's a scenario in which I start actually winning this game will help you make these like greedier lines.
Mm-hmm. And that's why you see high level players tank so often. Like it's usually at points where like a deviation has to occur. So it's like one, recognizing like, okay, what does winning look like? And then you have to kind of like foresee the next couple of turns, like how they have to play out for you to get there as well. And then you have to calculate like how likely are these things to happen versus this line and that kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, the beauty of Fab is it's best of one, right? So like there's no actual point in scooping. You might as well play to your out and try to win. There's no advantage gained of like going to game two. It's not a thing.
Yeah. And I'm not trying to advocate that like we need to completely play the game differently. These thoughts like came up in my head because I was doing all of my stats from all of my like tier 4+ events. And I basically like 5%, I need to win 5% more games. Like I need a 5% more win ratio to like top half of the events that I went to. And I'm just like, and that's a lot. Like an extra 5% is like way more than it sounds. Like for example, I'm running like 95% win rate in limited at tier 4+ events. And I'm like, if I was at 80%, then like I top a couple of these events more than likely, like, you know, assuming obviously everything changes, but like assuming, and it's like, so where in my play can I find like an extra 5% win? And it's like really led me to like start digging into these other type of plays and ways to think about the game that like, I just don't think we've been doing previously. It's just been like play the deck with the best math. And there has to be more. And obviously looking at the two different Dory decks play is like really shine that light on it. Cause like they were getting a lot more cards of their opponent's hand to do like doing absolutely nothing. And I was just like, there's something there. Like I don't 100% have like it all ground out and how to replicate that. But like, I was just constantly watching them play games where their opponent's just like, yeah, here's two cards out of my hand every round. And I was just like, the game's so easy. If you get two cards out of their hand every round playing Hatchet Dory, like this is super easy. And they're just like doing it every round. And I was just like, okay, there's something else there that's like not just math, right? Like there's a little bit more there.
That's so interesting with the Dory deck too, because I feel like with their builds, like holding an extra card, it kind of synergizes with the grains because you can dump it to like that Embracers. But it's also like if they have grains, they can't use the extra card because they don't have Tunic to get the third swing.
Yeah.
Unless they had like a Vigor to start. So I was like, I don't know. I have to watch those games again, see what you're talking about.
Yeah, it was something I saw in person when I was like standing there, like watching today. Sure. Some of them might be on stream because I did watch a lot of on stream games, but it was just like one of the things I noticed that they were getting that we weren't, but we were also like giving the opponent all the information what was happening on the turn. Like like half the game, we just show them this is exactly what's happening this round. Like you get to play with perfect knowledge. And there has to be some negative amount of value associated with that, that like we are not currently calculating, right? Like
that 100%
exists, right?
Yep.
Especially for certain classes as well. Like with Warrior, that should be one of your strengths is the hidden information.
Yeah. Like I mentioned to Cody after the event, I was like, I'm pretty sure we're just supposed to hold every hit and run instead of blocking three with it. Because one, you represent something on offense, but two, it's like your best arsenal card of the deck. So like you might as well take that three damage hit to go for a big play. And you also might get free equity, right? Just from repping an extra card.
Yeah. But that's the type of math that I don't think is being done by almost anyone right now.
I think it's also like the next level of that is you're supposed to vary your pattern too, right? You shouldn't just keep every hit and run, but you should, your tendency should be to keep more because you've determined it's mathematically better. But if you do it every single time, then you're predictable. So you shouldn't do it every time.
Okay. It was like an example. Like, we should be considering keeping cards instead of just doing the math and the we'd rather block than attack thing, right?
Agree. I just find that this is like another common thing of holding fab players back is being too like rigid and like, oh, they said hold every hit and run. Okay, I'm defaulting. I got to hold every single hit and run. I can never block with them. I always have to set them.
Yeah. Heuristics are good, but you need to know when to deviate. Agreed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Heuristics are for when you don't know what to do. Like that's how.
That's a good way of putting it.
That's always been the thing that I struggled when I was like talking to people about heuristics. I'm like, it's not the thing you always do. It's what you do when you don't know what to do.
Yeah.
Because in 99% of situations, you should know what to do. And like, but when you're unsure, then you go with the heuristic because more often than not, that's correct.
Yep.
But yeah, I just think it's something that I want to incorporate into like the next cycle that I'm working on is really thinking about things a little bit more, in this vein or some opportunities for these sort of things. Something that we should have done going to the Pro Tour would have been like, what if we just hold all our hit and runs? Like we should have like had a way to, we should have tested that, right? Like it should have been part of the strat testing, but it was like, that's not math. Like, you know what I mean? Like that's just, it's to be simple enough. There's a lot to do during a cycle, right? You can't do everything, but it's like another thing to just keep to add to the playbook of like, would we have a deck that we're in this spot with? And like, we can start testing this thing, doing this or doing that and like seeing what kind of equity we get when we do those type of plays. And I think that's just like the next part of the next evolution, I think, going into, you know, the game maturing. Cool. So anyone else have anything on the further go on the topic of that we've been talking about?
I'll just say it's also why like we all love Flesh and Blood, right? Like there's so much room for continuous improvement and like exploring new avenues to win games and strategize and all that. That's what makes the game so good.
Yeah. A lot of stuff is like kind of figuring out that because some negative result happened, I reflect back and think, okay, like what could I have done differently? And then that's where I develop the new skills. One that happens quite often in KO and kind of it happens a lot in Heavy Hitters Limited in general is with like the new windup cards being instant speed. And if we keep getting more instant speed cards in Part the Misfail, it'll be something that happens too, of just like always pausing to think. If you like send your whole hand at your opponent, they like block out. And then on their turn, they're just like trying to pass back to you of like drawing up your hand, taking a second to think. So that way you're not like telling your opponent, hey, I have this wind up because I thought this one turn. And then for three straight turns, I was like, no, pass back to me. It's fine. So yeah, little things like this that you may not identify as like a misplay in the sense of a game, because it's not like a actual mistake, right? You didn't do anything like wrong or negative math wise. It's just like you're basically telling your opponent that, okay, when I pass back immediately, I don't have a wind up. And when I think, then I do have a wind up.
Yep. So. And then if you get really good, you can keep the same speed when you have and don't have.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. If you have like infinite games on the deck, you just like draw the hand immediately, know whether you want to wind up on their turn or not. And you just like insta pass, but that's next level. I'm not there yet.
Yeah. Great. Okay. Let's dive into some of our Discord questions. These questions are from members of our premium Discord. If you'd like to be able to ask questions on the podcast, as well as get the game plans and the sideboard for the Hachidori deck, feel free and joining the Discord below. Okay, so the first question, I'm gonna shout out Fighting Walloon for linking the article in here for PV's rule number one. We kind of talked about it a little bit, and it's a little bit too in depth for like just like a short little question and answer thing. But I did want to give you credit for shouting that out to me. I was just like, I read it and I was like, that's the thing. That's what that is. Next question is going to be from Robo. It says, and now that Hatchet Dory list has eyes on it and Misfell's on its way, do you think that it's still the best tournament deck? And do you think people are going to be prepared for it and teched against it? If so, how? Yes. Going into week one of Pro Quest season, it is the best tournament deck in the game, in my opinion.
Yeah. Week one, absolutely. No question.
Because it can be Kano and it can beat Dromai, and then it has all the advantages of being a warrior.
Yeah, even if you're like practiced and like expecting it, like it's still hard to play against. The math is still the math, despite what we said earlier. Like the math is just really good on the deck.
Yeah, I think it'll only get harder too, because there'll just be more good players that have identified, oh, wait, this was like a real deck. There was like kind of a lot of sentiment that people didn't know Hatchet Dory was as good as it was heading into the weekend. So I anticipate that even better players will be picking it up and continuing to refine the list. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think it's pretty strong moving forward.
Yeah, I've been trying to play Kasai to prep for like after Dromai's gone. And it's like, man, it's really hard for you to play Kasai after playing Dory. It's
just like, I can't give up the third swing.
It is not having the third swing. Like once you get used to it, you're just like, what am I even doing on my turn with these stupid, terrible weapons? Like, now I'm just like, well, maybe just put hatchets in and it feels better. Cause you're just like, I swing for two. Like you play Take It on the Chin and then you're like, I swing for two. Why would I play this deck? This deck's terrible. Like if you go on your turn, you're just like, I blocked for a million and then I like swung for five or swung for additional because, you know, everything hit. Or now because I have Take It on the Chin, I can threaten a third swing. And you're just like, you can't do that, you know, with Kasai. It's been a hard adjustment to the point where I'm like, maybe I don't want to play Kasai. It's been spoiled with hatchets.
That's where I'm at. But yeah, I think post Dromai leaving, it gets interesting. I think it depends on how well you can tech your Dorinthea deck for like the brutes, which I think you can tech it pretty well once you get rid of the Dromai tech.
I mean, Kasai is definitely better into KO than Hatchet Dory is. Hatchet Dory can be better than how our build is currently. We sack some points into that matchup to be able to beat Dromai pretty consistently. And so that could get better in that aspect. But I will say playing as Kasai, it feels like way easier into KO personally, because you also have big power turns as well. That can be done on less cards.
I think Victor gets a lot easier too as Kasai.
I agree. I don't think anyone else is ever going to agree with that statement that you just made, but like, I agree.
Really?
Yeah. Everyone thinks Victor.
I thought Victor was like free for Kasai, but it's like pretty hard for Dory.
No, everyone just thinks Victor rolls both all the warriors.
Yeah, that's because they pop their gold to draw a card. You got to raise an army, guys.
Or you just wait till they run out of cards that say block on them, and then they have to play the game as a bad deck, and then you're like, yay. Yeah, so you just like
a card called Haw Streak. It's a pretty good card.
Yeah. The deck's only good if they have block cards, and then as soon as the block cards are all gone, then the deck's bad. So.
Yeah, just playing Betsy.
Yeah, just wait. Just wait until all good cards gone, and then play the game at like a reasonable health total. There you go. That's how you beat it. Done. Okay. Pappy's asking, what counters Hatchet Dory? And then it says, what are the top five decks you expect in the next big tournament? Unknown, because a whole new set is coming out. So legitimately can't answer that.
We got some friends overseas. They have the Calling in Poland, which is happening before the new set.
Yeah, it's Calling. I guess
that's post Dory, I assume.
It's post Dromai leaving, but pre the new set.
Or Dromai, rather, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. It's May 10th, the same meta, right? Probably.
I think, I think we'll see surprising, because I think Europe also loves Assassin. I think we'll see like a lot of...
We're seeing Ninja. 100% seeing Ninja.
Yeah, it's going to be Ninjas and Assassin. There'll be a lot of little
Europe. Yeah.
Attack for one go again. So, yeah, I think that'll be the one change. It's like Assassin and Ninja will show up much more representative than they are now with Dromai legal.
Yeah, there are three main decks.
I think Dory and KO stay on top, though.
That counter Hatchet Dory. One, Slab Dash or Tree Frog Dash, whatever one you want to call it, but Slab Dash. Yep. Number two, Teklovasin. Teklovasin is very, very hard, if not impossible.
There's a couple more.
Three, Second Cycle Kano. Very, very hard, especially if they have D-Reacts in their deck. That is like basically impossible if they have D-Reacts in their deck.
Unlucky. I mean, also, I'm drawing a blank. Azalea is very hard.
Hard, but not it's, in my opinion, not a counter. Not as much as,
if you're, one of the best Azaleas, but that's fair. I would just put a OTK Viscerai in that category then.
Yep, OTK Viscerai.
Like, true OTK. Not, attack in the middle of the game and give me a chance to win Viscerai. True OTK Viscerai.
Yep. So a lot of fringe decks, right? A lot of... Okay. Next one from Mike from Blackout Party says, looking back at Heavy Hitters Limited, what is one functional change to a card that you think could be changed to help balance the format?
I have a bunch of these, so if y'all
go ahead, because I have zero.
We answered this on the Lost episode as well.
Yeah, the Lost episode is going to come out on Friday. So it's going to come out. It's going to say Lost episode. We're just slamming it out there. Good luck with that one.
Well, I'm bad. I haven't seen the Lost episode, so I have no context.
Well, no one has. It's only Dan and myself.
It's just Cody and I talking for like 30 minutes before the printer.
So yeah, we'll see if we have some of the same ideas. But you, Mike's question was about changing cards. So I had like 4 ideas. I'll try to make it quick. The first one was about like the reprints. So I personally think Adrenaline Rush and Lunging Press were like kind of pointless remakes or reprints in the set. Like Adrenaline Rush ended up being sort of okay. We kind of figured out towards the end that it was like maybe playable in Warrior, but it was just like absolutely abysmal in both of the other two classes. And even in Warrior, it was like your deck had to be made to work with it. So I would have like leaned in more toward the like token game plan. We had like Prime to Fight was like a Majestic that cared about tokens blowing up. And we have like the Dabinod Out as another card that like, you know, like spams a bunch of tokens. So I would have made like a one cost attack that like I would have made a new card basically instead of Adrenaline Rush, like a one cost attack generic base 4 that says it gets +1 for each differently named aura token that was destroyed on your side of the field this turn. Max of 2 just to balance it for constructed so you didn't have like, you know, people going crazy. But basically it's like a card that could be a potential 1 for 6. So it's like still in the same strong category as Adrenaline Rush. But it would be a one cost attack, which is something we didn't have at all in the set, which I felt was kind of like awkward in both Brute and Guardian, where like if you just had a random vigor token but had to block out the turn, you like couldn't do anything with it. Whereas in Warrior, like a random vigor token was like crazy strong, right? It's just print 2 damage. So I think having like one cost attack would actually have helped a lot in the set, like from a generic standpoint that all classes could get.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that.
Okay. I didn't expect it to violently disagree, but.
No, I don't think it needs it.
Yeah.
But mm-hmm. I think a generic one cost would have been nice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I will say Adrenaline Rush was my Band-Aid for my bad decks. Like my deck was like truly bad, I was like slam one red, one yellow Adrenaline Rush. My whole game plan is to resolve both of these for the effect. And then like it actually works, which is kind of silly.
Yeah. Another thing that I thought of was instead of in the same vein of like reprints, instead of reprinting Pack Hunt, I think to give Reinar more like play, because it was like, I think 85% is even generous of like the time your Brute deck should be KO as opposed to Reinar. If instead of making Pack Hunt to where it's just essentially like, why have Reinar's hero power when you have KO, they could have made a card that's the same stats, just like vanilla 2 for 6, 5, 4, but it just said draw, discard, like the same text as the cards that don't block, but without like any of the benefit, just like draw, discard. So that way, like in a Reinar deck, you still have the value of the intimidate most likely. While it's like more synergy with the set and not just like staple intimidate on a card to cheese people like turn 0 or the last turn.
I don't know. I think that's unplayable.
I didn't say it.
Like if you're playing Reinhardt's because you don't have a lot of sixes, mm-hmm. and if you have to discard a 6 to intimidate, that's just not going to do it. I think we'd have to get around that somehow.
Yeah, the card could be better. I just didn't want to make it something too strong, but I was saying in general,
that makes
like
sense.
Another like
just make it a Reinar spec, make it a common Reinar spec. 2 for 6 intimidate.
I don't think they've ever done that, but like I would be totally fine with it just being a card that goes around that just says like Reinar intimidate. Like that's it. That's just, it's just pack up that says Reinar on it.
Yeah. If KO -1 power.
Obviously, I'm a little biased because like I lost one of my matches to just double pack hunt and at Pro Tour from 6 when my opponent's at 1. And so like, yes, no pack up makes me very happy.
Yeah, pack on such an absurdly powerful card.
Yeah, it just like it was such an outlier in terms of like what the other cards were doing and the fact that it also like blocked through. Just very silly.
No, I like taking that away from KO too.
Yeah, in KO it also just like changed like what made the format good in my opinion was like thoughtful blocking and then how to get around it and then like properly like trading your cards on both turns, and it just said like KO doesn't have to do that in this round.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Do you want to hear more?
Yes.
Okay. Sure. So the next one is about Lunging Press. That was another card that I always try to think of when I think about like set design. It's just stuff that's interesting to me of like making it new player friendly. And I feel like we kind of had the logic of most of the buffs in the set were things that worked on your class's attack. So like it worked on both the weapon and like the normal attacks. But then we just have like randomly lunging press being generic and only working on attack actions. So I was thinking like more thematic in the set to make a red react, like it only comes red, kind of how lunging press only comes blue. So a red react that buffs any of your attacks. So it can be like weapon or regular attacks by plus one for each differently named token currently on your opponent's side of the field, kind of like a down but not out concept. It's like if they have like an agility and a vigor, you like play this and it gives your attack plus two. So it's kind of like something that would have interesting counterplay by the opponent of like, they knew, okay, I have two tokens on board. My opponent's attacking and keeping one card in hand. There's a chance that they like give it plus two because I have two tokens. And it'd be two. Red two block attack react. Exactly.
Yeah. Sounds terrible.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Which is great. That's why I'm saying it's good. It's like good because the card's yellow, terrible.
Though, so we can see it in second cycle too, and like counterplay it. Like, oh, I got to break my tokens because he's, I got to not make tokens because I know the react's coming.
Yeah, exactly. Something like that. I just think it'd be cool. It doesn't have to be a super strong card. Just like,
no, I'm with you, though. Yeah, I like that. I think the lunging press, it's unintuitive.
Even if it was just like a new lunging press that just worked on everything, that would be fine as well.
Yep.
I definitely say that there was definitely some times early in the set where I was like, lunging press my saber, and they're like, you can't do that.
I was so excited to like wheel that in my warrior draft. I was like, oh, it's a blue non-attack and it's an attack react. This is so good.
Yeah, super.
I had like one attack in that deck.
Yeah. Okay. Last one is for Guardian. I felt over the top. It's like the one that says it has overpower if it has more attack than its base. That card also just like kind of made no sense. It felt out of place. So I was thinking that would be better if it had an on hit of like how the other ones have on hits, but this one's on hit was to destroy an aura token on your opponent's side of the field. So it'd be like a way of actually combating your opponent proactively if they had like an agility set up, vigor, might, whatever.
Yep, ship it.
It could also destroy all of the auras.
Well, that card already exists. So I was thinking it's like, you know, the baby version.
Yeah,
baby version that costs three. I think that sounds sweet.
Yeah. So there are my ideas. If they ever get slotted into a future set, you know, LSS is spying on our podcast.
Yep. No, I would ship all of that.
Yeah.
Except for the Reinar thing. You got to add the spec to it.
Yeah, the Reinar one. I started off weak. You know, you got to build up.
Yeah. Renzo, next question here says, would you consider Great Axe in the sideboard and against what deck? No. And I have no idea. Like, I love, it's my favorite weapon in the game. It's my favorite weapon that's ever been printed. I actually had a pod. I was actually on Fresh and Buds podcast this week, which will release on Thursday. And we talked about that. That was my answer to the question, what's your favorite weapon of all time? And it's Decimator Axe is my favorite weapon of all time. But I do not see any matchups I want this weapon in for the current way that the Dory list works. Even post Dromai, I just don't know what matchup I want to play Great Axe in. I mean, Dan, do you disagree?
I'm taking your word for it. I didn't play any Great Axe Dory, really. Like, I maybe played like two or three games.
There are 100% matches that I want to be Decimator Great Axe Dory in, but I can't with the current configuration of the deck. You lose all of the things that make the deck winnable by playing it. Like, you need Refraction Bolters. Like, you need to be able to threaten the second swing. Mm. Like, you need Sharpened Steel to be able to like pump it. Like, you need these other tools, and you need more shunts to be able to take advantage of the fact that your hand now blocks for more than it's supposed to be able to block for. And like, without these other tools, the Decimator Act story deck doesn't work nearly as well. And so like, and because you don't have room for all those tools and it wouldn't be worth it for those matchups, then it's like, there's no point in playing Decimator Great Axe.
Yeah, I could see it being like Dromai, where it's just like, we cannot beat this deck unless we do something drastic. And maybe Great Axe will be the answer for one of these new heroes or something.
Maybe.
Yeah, I feel like if you want to play Great Axe, you should just play Slab Dash. It's like kind of the same thing, right? Like, you shoot for two and two, they have to give you a card on one of the pistol shots. So like, their card's only blocking two.
Yeah, but Shunt though.
Yeah, or you can just play Great Axe.
Yeah, because Shunt though.
Forget hatchets.
I guess. I don't know. I'm not a believer in either strategy, so I don't have that strong a feeling.
That's just because Great Axe is bad into KO.
Yeah.
Yeah. If it was better into KO, I'd be playing Great Axe Dory right now and not Hatchet Dory. But like, Decimator Grey Axe doesn't beat KO. So, the end. Okay, and we answered this on the Lost podcast, but we can ask it again here by Dub. It's going to say, if your main goal is to improve and learn from every match you play, what are three questions that you ask yourself after each game when reflecting on a match?
You want me to go first?
Yeah, I'll let you go first.
Okay. So the first thing I do, we were kind of talking about this before we started recording, is to look at the state of the equipment. So if we're talking about strictly like what happens at the end of the game, I assume you mean like not necessarily after you've entered the result, but like when the game is nearing its conclusion as well, is just like evaluating the equipment on both sides of the field and reflecting back to how you used your equipment, whether that was offensively or defensively. And thinking about based on if you have a game plan, okay, did it align with your game plan, or did you have to make some, you know, on the fly change because they did something you weren't expecting and you ended up like not getting a lot of value, like what Cody was talking about earlier of the flesh bag, right? I think it's one of the easiest equipment to identify whether you got value out of it or not. It's like, if your game plan is to flesh bag them if you're playing into Warrior, your plan is to flesh bag them on a turn when they are just repping one card in hand and you think it's a go again, but they never sequenced their hand in such a way where you could do that, and then you ended up just randomly throwing it away for two value later on in the game. That's like one thing you can identify. Another one would be like your Apex Bonebreaker, right? Like, did you block in such a way where you got a mite off of it both times, or did you let your life get too low to where you just had to block to not die at the end of the game? So I think
let's be honest that. There. The only time they're blocking with that arm piece is when they have CNC in their hand. I swear, every single time I see that card put in front of another card, I go, they have CNC. Okay, let's go. And every single time they have CNC.
Yep. So yeah, another reason why people should be varying their patterns. Like, I don't know, CNC for seven is kind of a meme when your opponent plays Dynamo, but it's a different conversation. So those are just like ones that are top of mind in terms of like being defensive with your equipment. Are you throwing them away too early? Did you hold them for too late? Because that's like the thing that's easiest in your control because it's face up, right? There's no like draw sequence that influences really when you're getting value out of your equipment. It's something that is easiest to be in your control during the match.
I think those are good points for sure. I mean, that's like, that's the one that's like easy to identify. Every time they block with that arm in a spot that I'm like, why are you blocking here? Like, this doesn't accomplish anything. It's always because they have CNC and they're like, I want that seven. I want that seven though.
Yeah.
So I think that's funny. That was obviously their game plan going into the, that's like a heuristic that obviously a lot of like KO players have. And it's pretty funny on the other side that you just like, you're kind of giving up too much information that's like the only way you play.
Yeah, exactly. This is the perfect example of illustrating my point. Like, maybe it's actually proper in this matchup to use them to just block a two power hatchet to deny a third swing, for example. And like, that's actually worth more than your fake, you know, CNC for seven being taking three cards when they have shoes.
And yeah, I would just say it is.
Yeah.
Like on the hatchet, you're at least like blocking the gloves from plus one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And like you said, blocking seven is a joke for Warrior.
Yeah.
I just, you reminded me of that when you started talking about when you brought it up and I was like, hey, this is the thing.
Another one too is like certain decks, there's not that many of them that exist in Fab, but the one that comes to mind first is Bolton. If you're playing Saber combo, like you want to be thinking about in your game, is the goal of my equipment to block for the ability to let me charge my soul without having to leak too much damage? Or is it, I'm just going to fridge them and then present my like triple lumina and I need to like never block with my equipment the whole game because I need to triple lumina them, for example. So like there's some heroes too, where you want to think about your equipment in context of what threats your opponent would present if you're playing into like an Azalea for example, that's like a matchup where you're definitely going to want to be like, okay, I need to save my equipment so I don't get inertia away. So you may have to like leak damage early on, and it seems face up like, wait, why would you take this infecting shot when you could have just thrown a two block equipment in front of it? But it's because like you need to guarantee be able to deny the on hit later on in the game that prevents you from enacting like your I win this turn strategy.
Yep, agree. I mean, it's very similar in chain. If you're playing a chain mirror, then like the only thing you wanted to use your husk on was CNC by your opponent. Like, so most of the game came down to like trying to guess when they were going to play their CNC and like try and feel out based on like what patterns that they presented to you. And then whoever could like correctly put their husk in front of the CNC had like a huge advantage in the matchup. Mm-hmm. Like nothing else. They'd come in for like 8, 10, 12. I take it. CNC. Husk. Like, yep. That's it. That's the whole game plan was just put husk in front of this one card.
Yeah.
So I think that's a good point.
Yeah. One more too. Sorry, Dan. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're brewing something there. I got one more.
No, I can do mine again, or I can listen to the lost episode. Okay. Either way is fine.
Fair. So yeah. So, the other one is Tunic. Like so many decks in the game play Tunic now. So I think something to reflect back on, I always try to think about, this is kind of like two-pronged topic. The first thing I try to think about is like whenever I'm debating whether this is in testing or in like an actual tournament of like, okay, I was considering playing card X, but instead I registered card Y for this event. So every time I draw card Y, I want to be thinking about, okay, what if it was card X, right? So the first aspect of this is if it's like in the Brute deck, for example, a lot of people play Enlightened Strike. So you always want to be thinking about like, okay, if I draw this Enlightened Strike, is the Enlightened Strike better in this situation than a two-cost Brute attack? Or if I draw this two-cost Brute attack, is it better than an additional wind-up that maybe lets me play my whole hand, whatever? Just always be thinking about the cards that you, if you look on like my maybe board in February for all my decks, it's like 200 cards. Because I'm always thinking, I'm like, okay, like, what are the other cards that could go in these like 15-ish spots is kind of the sweet spot I feel in a deck in Fab of like the cards that are not 100% locked in, set in stone, that are somewhat mutable. So yeah, so just like thinking about in game of like, okay, if this card was the other card, you want to constantly be improving your deck for the next event that you enter. So just be thinking about those other cards and spots. And where this goes to Tunic is building your deck. Like I think our team did a good job of finding the exact amount of cards to where you use your Tunic. You should be using your Tunic basically every time it comes on to three. You don't want to have too many cards that tax your Tunic, but you don't want to have not enough cards to where like you're never getting value out of your Tunic. So yeah, I think that's like a great starting point if your deck leverages Tunic as its primary chest equipment, is to construct your deck in a way where you're more likely to be able to get value out of it every three turns and not have it either stagnate or be too taxed.
I mean, there's the opposite argument. If you only need it once in a game, it still might be worth just running the Tunic if that once in the game is powerful enough. Mm-hmm. Right. And that was like one of the things. Stubby Fi is a great example of that. I mean, to the point where they ran the other chest pieces.
Blossom
just to get that $1 and off. And that was something that we recognized where grains is like was great and you can get a lot of value out of it, but like we really need the dollar when we need the dollar. We don't just need to, keep reoccurring it, right?
Yeah.
Cool. Well, I think we've covered a lot. It's been pretty great. Thanks for coming on, Noah, especially prepping all of those answers ahead of time is very helpful as well. But mm-hmm. I think I'm going to go play some Balatro. So I'm going to say goodbye, everyone. Yeah, let's go. Yep. Right, bye-bye. All right.